get out of the way.
Clicker?
This is a forward thing, so okay. You move it forward.
And then you need to pull it up really fast on
my
screen?
Oh, yeah, it's right here.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
And I'll get people together. Okay, so we have a presentation quickly here, and she will introduce what she's doing. Erica, cool. Take it away.
Hi, all. I'm Erica, and I've been working with Dr. Cooper this semester on my honors capstone, and it's on shrimp. So I bet you all didn't know that SOS, our shrimp, need saving. But they've actually been experiencing mass die-out since 2009. It started in China. And this came to Dr. Cooper's attention. Because he went to Belize a couple years ago and worked on a shrimp farm there. This is actually a picture of a shrimp farm. So, like, all the pools, these things are, like, where the shrimp live. It's just, like, big pools. And they rely on tidal exchange, like, with the ocean to, create fresh water in the pools so that they have, like, fresh water and nutrients for the shrimp. And there he met Shane and Colin, a marine biologist from the UK, and they've been kind of working together on this project, so I just jumped in with them. But actually, we have a shrimp killer called Vibrio parahemolyticus. And this thing is nothing new. It's been around for thousands of years. It normally just causes food poisoning in humans. So if you eat a shrimp that's undercooked and it has this, bummer for you. You'll just have, like, diarrhea for a couple days, but then you'll be okay after. But now, instead of, like, affecting humans, it's actually picked up the 70-kilobyte plasmid, which is a big deal for it because it's only, like, 240 kilobytes total. So that's, like, a pretty big part of it now. And it encodes for toxins, pure A and pure B. Which are pretty toxins, and they're pore-forming toxins. So what they do is they kind of bind to the cell membrane, and then they insert themselves in there, and together they kind of make this pore, which then any ions can flow through. And they're big enough pores that, like, large molecules can go through too. So if you guys can kind of imagine, this, like, ion regulation is kind of thrown out the window as this happens, because ions can just kind of go wherever they want to in the shrimp. So the shrimp die pretty fast, actually within 28 days of getting this. So it's a big problem for the shrimp farmers because they're losing all their stuff, and millions of dollars are being lost as shrimp farms have to shut down, which is a really big bummer. I like eating shrimp. So how do we figure out that this is happening to the shrimp? So when this happens, the shrimp kind of slough out their insides. So you can tell, this is a picture of a shrimp that has the disease. This is a picture of a shrimp that's okay. The stomach is right here. In the healthy shrimp, it's nice and full of food. In the not healthy shrimp, it's not really there even. The midgut and intestinal line is also emptied out in the diseased shrimp. And then the paddle pancreas. Crustaceans actually are kind of cool because they have a combined liver and pancreas. So that's the paddle pancreas right there. And it, like, creates the digestive enzyme. So you can imagine that if they don't really have a stomach and midgut anymore, then they don't really digest anything. So the hepatopancreas also atrophies. So it's a lot smaller. You can kind of see that in this picture a little bit better. The hepatopancreas is smaller than the normal shrimp. So those are all big problems for the shrimp. But the real question is, how do we save it so we can keep eating hibachi? And the answer comes to that from KY State. There's actually a shrimp farm up there. And it's really cool because we can try out a lot of these experimental treatments that people are looking at right now on those. The first step is looking into pure A and pure B toxin research because we don't know very much about them right now. Like I said, they're still new. There's an insect toxin called cryotoxin. It's pretty similar, and it's a pore-forming toxin. But we don't know much about that either. So the first step is to kind of figure out, are the pores it's making, are they all the same size? Or, like, how does it decide where and when to make the pores? Or how does that kind of work? Because of that, if they're all the same size, then we can use an ion channel blocker and kind of block them up. So, yeah, you have a pore in your body, but no, it's blocked up, so it doesn't really affect the shrimp. So that would be one way that we could solve the issue. Antibiotics are actually working right now, but that's also a big problem because if the antibiotics cure the shrimp and then we eat the shrimp, then we have the antibiotics. And antibiotic resistance is, like, a big deal right now due to that. The last thing that there's actually a lot of forward progress being made right now is with phage therapy. There's a phage called, that's when you take, like, one bacteria that's going to eat the other bacteria, and they both kind of flush out, and it's all okay. So Dr. Cooper actually sent me a paper this morning that they're making progress with that, that they found some bacteria, like bacteriophages, that will work for this kind of treatment. So that's really cool. The only issue with this is, like I said, this is, like, the oceans we're dealing with. And so if we just stick a phage in there, like, the chances that it might also affect something else sometimes are pretty high. Right now in the laboratory, they're just, like, injecting the phages into the shrimp, so that's really controlled. But when you have, like, millions of shrimp around the world, these shrimp farms, it's kind of hard to go around to every single shrimp and inject it with this. The other issue is that if you don't inject it within, like, the first, like, 6 hours of it being infected, then it doesn't work very well. So it's kind of hard also to be, oh, man, my shrimp got a disease 6 hours ago. Better go and fix it. So that's kind of some of the problems that we're facing today. And the next kind of steps are basically looking into how we can fix that. So that's what my honors project was on this semester. And this is just a shrimp farm at KY State. Dr. Andrew Ray, he's a cool guy, likes shrimp a lot. So that's that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Honors project done, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, she's got references. Okay, so the game plan today is to really quickly go over a few last-minute things, and then we can have a review, and hopefully it'll all be good, and we have a little quiz. That's not so bad, and we'll hand out the rest of these other assignments. So just to kind of wrap up, there were a few things that we didn't cover on the renal that you want to note. Hint, hint. You want to know? Okay. And that is, we didn't really cover glomerular filtration rate. And I think we covered a little bit of this a while back, but to kind of re-emphasize it again. And, you know, sometimes it's called clearance. That might be an easier way to kind of remember it, too. And I try to come up with crazy ways to remember things, right? So clearance equals what? UA, right? Urine concentration times the flow over plasma concentration, or UV, you can think of it, or urine flow. So you can think of clearance, or maybe cancer with UV, you know, protection. And if you protected it with sunscreen, you could actually decrease your cancer or something. I don't know how you might remember it. There were different ways that people try to remember this, but glomerular filtration rate is this urine concentration over the urine flow over whatever you have in your plasma. So the idea here is if you injected inulin, for example, I think we talked about inulin before, right? This is the way that they can check your kidney function. So inulin is a substance that they would inject into you. It's not reabsorbed in your nephron. It's not secreted in your nephron. So it's a really good index for glomerular filtration rate, right? Because it's not reabsorbed and it's not secreted. So it's just what's filtered. But creatinine, is creatinine more than just filtered? Anybody remember? Creatinine? It's secreted, mostly in the distal tubule. A lot of things are secreted in the distal tubule. So here we have a substance that's secreted and filtered. So this is why creatinine is used commonly as a blood test for looking at your kidney function. So they can look at creatinine. If creatinine levels are high, what does it indicate? Your kidney might not be filtering well, but it might not be secreting well either, right? So if you did a creatinine test and you measured creatinine levels and they're too high, that could be a problem. And if you did the inulin test along with that, then you could get glomerular filtration rate and then your creatinine levels, and you can actually subtract the two and realize, hey, I'm having a problem with creatinine not being secreted. Your kidneys aren't working well, right? And why might you want to do this? Well, people with kidney failure, for example, acute renal failure, or if they're having some other problems with ion balance, then you know that there's some problems with secretion. But think of somebody that might be have an infection, they kind of take antibiotics. There's also a problem, right? Because the antibiotics are not only filtered but secreted. And if you can't secrete them, then your excretion rates value, you know, changes, and then you get up to higher levels in your antibiotics, and then you have toxicity, right? So understanding the renal function is important. Glomerular filtration rate is the way to measure that. Hint, hint, we're covering this for a reason. You might see this in a couple of days, all right? And hemodialysis, a lot of people are on hemodialysis. And there's all different types of hemodialysis. There's some that are just in the abdomen. For example, they'll put a tube in your abdomen and drain excess fluid versus actually taking blood and going through hemodialysis tubing and then trying to exchange out the waste products. And people are usually fatigued with this response. And let's see, I pulled up a web page for this. Let's see if it'll open. Mm-hmm. There it is. It's coming. So it's pretty interesting because if you look at the fatigue, you would think that maybe it could be understood. Why do you have hemodialysis fatigue? So people that some people go three times a week, you know, this is really heavy for them. And if they don't do it, their toxic levels will build up and they can die from this, right? Or have neurological problems and heart problems. And some people maybe only have to go once a week. So some people are going to this quite often, and it's a real issue. If you ever want to volunteer, you can actually volunteer for these kind of groups and transport people back and forth. Lots of neat things. But so they call this chronic fatigue syndrome. And with hemodialysis, and when you look at this, it's really not understood exactly why it is. So you would think that it might be, you know, the lack of glucose, or maybe your ion balance. So they measure all these things, and still they can't figure out why people are so fatigued after hemodialysis. It's not really the breaking down of red blood cells. You know, what is it, right? And you think something that's so important, where so many people are getting hemodialysis, that they could beef this up and actually have people back to working again. But really, it runs them down very heavily. So it's not so simple. It's really been a big problem, the mental part of it, as well as just the physiological, not being able to, you know, want to move. That's the psychological, but then your muscles are really fatigued. And so people actually try to study this by stimulating nerves and recording in muscles and finding out, is there something wrong with synaptic transmission, or is there something wrong with the muscle not being able to function as well? And it's still somewhat of a mystery exactly what's causing this dialysis fatigue. So it's kind of interesting. A lot of research that still can be done. So this is what I'm trying to tell you. Not everything is known, right? There's a lot of unknowns out there in physiology. So that's something that's kind of interesting to think about, too. Okay, so back to our wonderful wrap-up. Okay, so we might cover something on hemodialysis fatigue, right? Okay, yeah, people on echo, too. All right. A few things on this kind of wrap-up. It's a little bit of a review as well. So this is bringing it all together. Respiratory quotient, so RQ values. And this is a really neat way to measure function or metabolism in animals. And you can see here, you know, the carbohydrates, right? What's your famous tattoo that you should have gotten by now? You know, C6, H12, you know, O6 plus 6 oxygens equals 6 CO2s and water, right? Metabolic water. And you see that the 6 and 6, if you take the ratio, it's 1. So you can actually measure this in animals and figure out what kind of foods they're eating. Or you can give them a particular type of food and look at their respiratory quotient by measuring the oxygen and CO2. So note the equation at the top and which one is on top of the other, right? So it's products over reactants, right? So the respiratory quotient, CO2 over oxygen. All right, so it's a neat way to measure cellular metabolism, but then the whole animal. All right, so you can actually put them in a chamber and measure this. And people have done this, and if you're in ag sciences, for example, you might be doing this in some of those the classes with the lab. So they actually do some of these experiments. Anybody done this in their ag science class? Anybody in the ag sciences? No? They got some really good courses over there. If you're into reproductive endocrinology, they have a whole semester of reproductive endocrinology, too. It's a pretty neat course. Okay, but the idea is that you can actually put, like, peptone, or remember that cow I mentioned that they have an open cavity on the side of the animal with a closed window and they can put food in and they can actually then measure the type of metabolism with them. They can actually put a mask around them. They can measure the CO2 output and oxygen consumption. So that's pretty cool. But you get the idea as they consume oxygen and the CO2 is produced, right? Just to kind of remind us about the elephant mouse curve. Because you see this on standardized exams, and it's a fundamental concept, right? But sometimes people are a little confused with this. Of course, a big animal, like an elephant, uses more oxygen per minute, right? Because it's big, right? It takes one big breath. It's probably, you know, I don't know how many times more than a mouse, but a lot. But if you calculate it per weight, so the metabolic mass-specific metabolic rate for the homeotherms, the mouse is much higher, right? But it's a low body weight. Why is this again, generally? Homeotherm, hint, hint. What do homeotherms have to do? Homeotherm, therm? Anybody? Maintaining their temperature, right? So, but they have a big surface area to little volume, right? So they're dissipating that heat a lot, right? So their metabolism has to be high. Compared to the elephant, which is small surface area compared to the big mass doesn't lose as much heat. It can keep that heat inside. And the same kind of idea with like a hydrated camel, right? They don't lose that the heat so fast because the water could keep maintain the heat. So this this called the elephant mouse curve, common in biology, with metabolic rate, specific metabolic rate. And then you look at the size of the animal. This is different. This is metabolic rate per mass of the animal, but the larger the animal, then the total metabolic rate is higher because they use more oxygen and produce more CO2, the bigger the animal. But this works all the way through from simple organisms to mammals. All right, and some kind of gee-whizzy stuff, but just to make sure that we understand this. You know, a large animal is going to take longer to slow down after it starts moving. It's like inertia, back to your physics, right? Wants movement, wants to stay at movement, right? And at rest, it wants to stay at rest. So it has to exert a lot of energy to keep to get going, right? And then it might take longer for it to kind of slow down if it needs to. But once it gets going, then it can actually keep that maintained locomotion, where a smaller animal might have to keep it up at a higher level for metabolic rate. And the same idea, this velocity, right? A little animal can move quickly, get it going, compared to a larger animal. So you think back to your ecology class, trying to pull it together, you know, predator-prey relationships and things like that. Think of that larger animal, it's going to take it a lot of energy to get going. And then once it gets going, it just kind of maintains, right? Whereas that littler animal doesn't have to, it doesn't have as much inertia to overcome, basically, and then it can maintain that at a low rate, too. Okay.
When you say something's going to be on a standardized thing, do you mean that's going to be on your hand?
That's a good hint. Yes. Because I try to make sure that not only for a lot of people that are going to take those exams that you've got this material down, you can say, yes, I learned that in physiology. And, you know, we didn't forget to talk about that. But it's also a major point I'm trying to make in here. Okay. And then some other kind of gee-whizzy stuff. And if you've been working in labs, you know, you can measure activity in different ways, like a mouse on a running wheel. This is really quite common in the rodent field, but they look at this in other ways too. But it's actually abnormal. It's not a normal aspect of locomotion. So there was a nice talk at Indiana University we went up to a while back, and they actually put these little wheels out in the field, and they tracked other mice, and they found out that mice in the field really didn't move as much. But if you put these little wheels out there, they like to get on top of them and run, and they actually increase their running rate than they naturally would move, like a Fitbit kind of thing, in their early environment. So then when people measure that in the lab, you wonder, is that really normal, or is it, you know, kind of excessive? It's kind of like some addiction going on. It's like a kid on the game thing, you know? Or this generation, maybe you're still playing games. I don't know. Okay. All right. And, you know, just different ways to measure locomotion. Think about that. So you think about, we didn't really cover circadian patterns in here. We have a whole course in circadian patterns and sleep. It's a really good course. Julie Pendergast, Bruce O'Hara, and Vincent Cassone teach that course, kind of in and out different semesters. But it's a really good course. You get down to the mechanisms of action. But what's really neat is animals are entrained this way. So even if you look at marine animals in an intertidal zone, they're already getting ready for that tide to drop out or to come back in. You can put those in the lab, and they maintain that kind of circadian pattern. And you wonder, how is it that they do that at a cellular level, right? You can even take Drosophila eggs, and you can pulse them, like 12 hours light on, 12 hours light off. Look at them as larvae, you know, for first, second, third instar and pupa. And they don't show a circadian pattern in that period. But then you look at them as adults, they'll actually be entrained with their circadian pattern that you started as an egg. So how is that happening? How is it happening that they remembered that after 6 days when they didn't show a circadian pattern, and all of a sudden they have that? And Drosophila, you know, the Nobel Prize? Anybody remember what the Nobel Prize was this year? Or this academic year? Three people, all in circadian pattern, and they've started their work in Drosophila. And that, why is that so important? Because they could understand the genes in Drosophila that work in you to understand your circadian pattern and your cycles. And they've actually shown that in all different tissues in your body. So pretty neat. Actually, Brian Ryman, that was Brian Ryman. If anybody's had Brian Ryman for class, anybody had Brian Ryman for class? Yes. his advisor was one of the Nobel Prize winners, actually, so that's pretty cool. And so if you think about behaviors, it goes with your ecology class. I'm trying to pull it all together. Animals that might feed, right, stay up at that high level to maybe eat krill, and then they can dive down to avoid predation. So you think about everything together we've been talking about with physiology. You know, what's the selective driving pressures for their behavior, and then even down to the cellular level, kind of like that desert kangaroo rat that we've talked about with the long. Which loop of Henle is the longest one now? Everybody learned that now? Cortical or medullary nephron?
Medullary
nephron. So many people miss that on this test. I don't know why, really. Because we talk about the desert kangaroo rat quite often. Okay, so the last kind of wrap-up part is about acclimation. And to animals that you actually look at, if you acclimate animals to a particular temperature, particularly invertebrates, they then show better survival to a temperature change that's like to that temperature. So if you acclimatize them to higher temperatures, and then you bring them back down to, say, room temperature, and then you re-expose them to high temperature, they'll actually be much better off than just the initial exposure. And the same thing happens with cold conditioning, so we'll talk a little bit about that. So the idea is that you can condition these animals to really survive well by giving them that pre-exposure a bit. Or also, that fits very well with behaviors of animals. Like frogs that sing, if you took the male bullfrog, for example, and brought that down to a lower temperature, and it sings at a different frequency and pitch, the female won't respond. But then if you bring the female down, then it will start to respond. So you think, oh, the sensory nerves have to change their behavior to understand that difference in temperature. And you bring that male back up, and the female's down here, it won't respond until that female comes back up the same temperature. So the nervous system with temperature conditioning is pretty cool, too, to think about conditions. So Q10 is a common phenomenon. Did you cover this, Q10, in biochemistry? Did you cover this in biochemistry? No. It should. It's really a neat way. You can actually look at enzymes and their function every 10 degree change. So you can measure an enzymatic function at a Q10, and then you can measure the whole animal at a Q10, but you can break it down to individual enzymes and how they function at the cellular level. So metabolism, for example, or digestion, or other kinds of aspects. So Q10 is every 10 degree temperature change. You measure whatever it is that you usually are measuring, and usually it's oxygen consumption. It could be something else, like CO2 consumption, or enzymatic reaction, for example, the products that are coming at every 10 degree temperature change. But this is a common measurement in biology, and particularly physiology, and understanding how animals function at different temperatures. We're bringing it all back to the membranes, their beginning of the class, right? And remember what happens in cold versus warm to those biological membranes. What are the three things we need to remember? One, makes little kinks. What makes the kinks? Yeah, what's it called?
Saturated
versus unsaturated, right? So the kinks are unsaturated. No hydrogen, not all hydrogen. What's the other part? Cholesterol, but also length of the carbon chains, and then those big cholesterol molecules that go in there, right? So those are the main three things to kind of think about with cold or warm. Remember which way they go? Cholesterol are the little rug rats in the kindergarten, right? Inhibit you from moving around. Generally, that's the way to think about that. And temperature is really a cool approach to look at. But the idea here is if you acclimatize or acclimate insects to, say, a cold temperature, like you expose them a little bit, maybe bring them back to warm and bring them back to cold and bring them back to warm, and you keep doing that little by little, you can actually have them survive really well at cold temperatures, for example. The same with warmer temperatures. And there are proteins that not only Drosophila expresses, but you do as well. They're called heat shock proteins. These are accessory proteins that go around a protein to maintain its structure and function, like enzymes, right, that would change their conformation under different temperatures. But these heat shock proteins go around them and help maintain their structure so they can keep functioning. So heat shock proteins are really neat. A lot of understanding from Drosophila and relating to mammals. But also heat shock proteins, just because of their name, they also function, you know, they first tested them with higher temperatures, but they also looked at them in cold temperatures. So a number of heat shock proteins also work and exposure to cold temperatures too to help maintain conformation. So enzymes and proteins, right, can still function. So that's the idea with the seed shock proteins. And I think we all understand then temperature regulation. If you're out on a hot day, hopefully it'll start warming up a little bit. You can get heat from the radiation off the ground, direct sun radiation, and how you cool off, like evaporative cooling, right, from the wind and sweating. So just the idea of temperature regulation. What's really neat is, just like in you, on a cold day, your hands, you know, if you put it in ice water, for example, might turn white because you vasoconstrict those arterial beds out there, right? What is this all trying to do? What's the main point of this for mammals? Maintaining core body temperature, right? Maintaining your core body temperature. You don't want cold blood coming back and cooling down your core body temperature. So you vasoconstrict out there. And if you overheat, what happens? You vasodilate, right? And you start sweating. And you really sweat quite a bit on your palms and on the soles of your feet, right? And some people actually cool off. If you just do this, I mean, think about it. I think we talked about that before, right, in the labs. If you just wave your hand on your palm, you know, like when you're taking a test and you're all sweaty, just do it like that. You don't have to wave your face. Look, I mean, you really feel the coolness of it, right? It's pretty neat. And so, isn't that cool? That's cool. And so, okay. And you think about it, you have a lot of sweat in your palms. And when you get nervous, you might be sweating, right? And that's one way to cool off. All right. So it's kind of neat. There's, you know, the shunting of the blood away from the periphery or to the periphery. And you might think about different animals with the way they do this. You know, the seals with the blubber, right? I try to tell my wife that's why I want, you know, in the winter, but she doesn't quite agree with me. But anyways, fur also, and, you know, that hair that's on animals, they've actually looked at poodles, for example, you know, even the black poodle with hair. If they put the temperature probe right underneath the skin and they put the animal in the sunlight, for example, or a heat light, if they leave the hair on, it actually is cooler. But then if they shave the hair off, even for the black hair that would absorb the heat, it actually was warmer if they cut the hair off. So sometimes, you know, cutting all the hair off the dog might actually make it hotter in some aspects. It depends on if it's trapping air as insulation. Your best insulation is actually air, you know, because it doesn't conduct the heat. So keeping that air there is actually very good. So there's some really neat aspects. And we understand about cold-blooded animals, the chelotherms, right, versus homeotherms. Go too cold, too hot, you got a problem for the homeotherm, right? Because you're going to die on one end, you're going to die on the other end, right? So that window that you want to stay in for maintaining temperature. But think, there's a gradation in these animals. And not to just go away thinking that cold-blooded, that's it. They're going to be exposed to their environment. What can they do? They can have a behavioral change, right? They can start moving. They can be like the butterfly that will get its, you know, wings out towards the sun. They might ramp up metabolism themselves if they can, right? And start moving. Even fish can start moving more in cold water, and they can maintain their body temperature a little bit more. So it's not so cut and dry, and that's kind of the idea, is that they can somewhat regulate their temperature by behavioral changes.
So if they're like moving more, would that kind of increase in their temperature?
If they move more?
Yeah.
Their increase of enzymatic activity in their body raises the temperature. It's kind of like shivering for yourself, right? You can raise your body temperature. That's why you shiver, right? And that's kind of neat. So the idea with cold, this is kind of interesting to pay attention to. Intent. All right. Is that you have multiple ways to, for insects to actually survive in the cold, and they can actually survive in the freezing temperatures for long periods of time. And it's kind of neat. And then you bring them back up, and all of a sudden they're back to life again, right? So there's lots of really neat examples of this. And some of them can survive for many, many years frozen and then come back. So you kind of think about, you know, species that have not been around for a while and then all of a sudden come back and get exposed. It's really quite cool. So there's multiple ways that animals survive. Some of these are to decrease the freezing inside the cells. So one idea is actually they will promote freezing outside the cell in the extracellular fluid. And what that does is it causes the water to start to freeze and the solutes build up out in the extracellular fluid. So this becomes hyperosmotic. Well, what's that going to do to the organelles inside? It's going to pull water out of those organelles, right? It's going to pull water out of a mitochondria out of the nucleus and into the extracellular, into that extra, it can be in the cytoplasm of the cell and get it out of the organelles for one aspect, and then you keep the organelles safe. So you don't want to freeze the organelles and damage them. But you can also pull that out into the extracellular fluid of the animal, so two ways, cytoplasm, and extracellular, and cause freezing to go on extracellular, but save the whole cell. And that's kind of neat. And how could they do that? By increased water excretion, right? So they can increase water excretion, raise their osmolarity, extracellular, pulls water out of their cells, and what does that do to the osmolarity inside the cell? Raises it so it decreases the freezing point, right? Just like putting salt out on the road, right? So it can decrease the freezing point so it won't freeze. This is an interesting way of getting rid of brain trauma, too. If somebody has swelling in their brain, they actually will put mannitol into their blood. And that mannitol pulls that fluid out of their brain, and it pulls it into the blood to keep swelling down. So this is actually used clinically to actually help people with brain swelling. So it's pretty neat, you know, ideas. And so understanding how other animals survive in the cold is pretty neat. So the idea is, too, they can actually make antifreeze proteins. Depends on the insect. Some insects can make glycerol that it's so thick that you can't even pipette the blood. It's so thick with glycerol. That's pretty neat that they can make glycerol like the stuff you put in your antifreeze for your car, right? And then they can change this extracellular fluid and start ice crystallization there and then raise osmolarity, pull water out of cells, or even cytoplasm, pull it out of the organelles. Many different ways. It's pretty neat. There's a guy over in entomology here, Teats, and he actually goes to Antarctica and studies invertebrates in Antarctica and their conditions, how they survive. So it's pretty neat. He takes undergraduates, works in his lab, and I don't know if you get to go to Antarctica or not, but he brings samples back, and it's really quite cool. Okay, so the idea is that insects, if you bring them like through a season, like in Kentucky, then you slowly bring them down, they can survive freezing temperatures. But if you took that same insect and you just put it in the freezer right away, it might die, right? So it needs to turn on this machinery. It needs to turn on the antifreeze proteins. It needs to turn on glycerol production. So this is why those seasons are important. And you might hear that, oh, the rapid cold knocked out the insects for this. I'm glad if all the mosquitoes die out, quite frankly. But anyways. And then what you did in lab, right, with temperature, you put cold water on your face, didn't you? Some of you were tortured with that, and your heart rates dropped, right? So that's not only in you, but it also exists in diving birds, even reptiles, the cold response, and the idea is to decrease your metabolism, right? So it's kind of neat to think about. And just the last kind of part is, you know, we function in this thermal zone. When you go too high, you're going to spend energy, right, to try to cool off, like fanning or panting. Or if you're too cold, you're going to spend energy to try to warm up. So the idea is keeping in that thermal zone, but if you go in the extremes, you spend a lot of energy and you deplete it and then you die, right? If it goes too far. We have brown fat in us when we're born. If you ever have a little infant that you're babysitting or have one in your family somewhere, feel between their shoulder blades and they'll have that chunk of fat between their shoulder blades. And it's really kind of brown fat. And they can actually maintain and keep their body temperature by burning that brown fat. So it's kind of neat. It's really no different than a bat that utilizes it and actually has neural input to this fat cells to break it down and raise metabolism. It's kind of like shivering. It's not really of any, you know, it doesn't cause them to move. It's just breaking it down. And that enzymatic process that goes on inside of brown fat raises the body temperature. Right? So it's pretty neat that you can just raise body temperature by burning the brown fat, or, say, like for us, we might shiver too. And they found some just recent information. They actually found brown fat in our skeletal muscles, and they are now trying to figure out why it's really there, even as adults. But it's below levels. And so it's kind of interesting new stuff that's coming around. Okay, and we've talked about cold. Neurons, I think we've talked about in our brain and the hypothalamus, we have regions that can detect these, right? Like trip receptors, the same idea of the capsaicin, the hot pepper that you might put on your skin. You feel hot, but it's not really hot because that receptor changes its conformation, right? Protein conformational change can change the fire. Well, you have those same receptors in your hypothalamus, but they're really responding to the temperature change in your blood, right? In your body temperature. But if you eat capsaicin, hot pepper, what happens? Your body thinks you're sweating, you're hot, so you start to sweat, right, to try to cool off. You've tricked your body, right? The temperature really didn't go up, but you're kicking in those responses. So those are the receptors in your hypothalamus in your brain. You don't have to memorize which receptor, which region is in the brain. Okay, and that's kind of cool, and you know about vasodilation, vasoconstriction, just kind of keeping with the book. All right, and we've talked about shivering and warming up. What's really neat is in some animals, they actually have what's called this reet, or ret, and it's actually a tuft of blood vessels, kind of like your glomerulus, a tuft of blood vessels, but it's not for ion exchange, it's for heat exchange. So they've looked in animals, and they couldn't really figure out what those were for until they began to realize that actually, as say like this sheep here, if it starts to pant, the air will move back and forth more, and it can actually cool the blood, the venous blood coming back into the animal, and if it exchanges with the arterial blood that goes by, it can actually cool off the arterial blood to keep the blood temperature, you know, within a range. So it's kind of neat that animals have these specialized cardiovascular system to actually help to maintain body temperature. Pardon? It's like a rift. This what they call RTT. It's just like the glomerulus, a tuft of blood vessels, Okay, and last part on hibernation. Really, animals aren't true hibernators. A lot of them, like we think that you might have, thought about, like a bear. Why? Because they don't really drop their body temperature for a long period of time. They might drop it for a little bit and come back up, drop it, come back up. But true hibernators, like some squirrels, are really hibernators. They drop their metabolism and they lower their body temperature for a long period of time. Why would a bear, why would that not be good for a bear, do you think? Big animal, right? What's the problem here? Why would the big animal not? Think how long it would take them to warm up. Right, it's going to take them a long time to warm up, a big body mass compared to a little squirrel, right? So they could actually heat up quicker if they had to have a predation or to respond to the environment. Then they could actually be ready faster if they didn't keep their metabolism all the way down, their body temperature all the way down. So true hibernators are like squirrels and some other rodents, but like a bear is not a true hibernator. Okay. And the last part about temperature, and it all comes back to what Erica was just talking to. Bacterial infections, like us, why is it that we raise our body temperature? Because they have an immune response. And it's pyrogens that raise your body temperature, and they work on your hypothalamus. And we kind of talked about that, I think, the second day of class or something. So it's kind of coming back to all that spot. And still to this day, all those little details aren't completely understood. Why some people have a much higher increased body temperature for the same kind of bacterial infection compared to somebody else. Maybe they're more sensitive to these pyrogens or cytokines that are released. That's pretty neat. Where is Jackson? Sophia? Oh, yes, there she is. She was working on this. You want to tell us what you're doing real quick? Real loud.
So I studied the innate immune response in horses to see if it had an effect on inflammaging that organisms go through. And so I simulated whole blood samples with a part of gram-negative bacteria called LPS, and then I measured the cytokine response.
So in case you didn't hear that in the back, she works in the veterinarian clinic over at UK, right? In the pretty cool lab. So if people want to work as doing research, she was taking blood samples out of horses and putting LPS in there and actually looking at the cytokine release versus different aged of horses. And the older horses had more cytokines, right? See, I remembered your poster. Okay, very good. So the same kind of neat aspect here, if you inject a pyrogen in an animal, they might even change their behavior, like a lizard, to go out and warm up in the sun to raise their body temperature. Isn't that pretty cool? What are all those mechanisms involved? Okay, and this shows you how pathetic we are about not being able to stand very long times without oxygen that will die relatively quickly. And there's some invertebrates that can actually last a very long time without oxygen. Okay, so that was all that good stuff, right? So we want to address questions. And in case you didn't see those things in Science Daily, great stuff. You know, they're actually finding animals now in climates that they never saw them before, like these bottlenose dolphins are up in Canada. They think it's because of the global climate change that's occurring, and now they're finding them in warmer waters. But then you think about what else is going to be in warmer waters? Bacteria, other things, maybe dinoflagellates, red tide. They're already seeing these things affecting areas which have never been exposed to these kind of aspects. It was really cool that just this morning, this came out in Science Daily, how diving animals, remember what we mentioned before about diving animals that go way down deep for a long period of time, like whales that can be down for an hour and not get nitrogen narcosis? Remember all that, maybe? Right? And the nitrogen narcosis goes into your tissue when your surface of bubbles expand. It pops these bubbles in your head, brain, and your heart, skeletal muscle. Well, they found out that some of these animals really aren't completely collapsing their lungs. They collapse part of their lungs. It's new stuff that just came out yesterday. So they collapse part of their lungs, and they keep that part perfused more so than the part that stays open. But the nitrogen can go into the parts that stay open because they're utilizing the oxygen, so that kind of comes out. And now that parts of the lungs that don't collapse builds up in the nitrogen, so when they do surface, they can blow out the nitrogen faster. Pretty cool. But, you know, new discoveries that they were finding, and they actually used cadaver, I think, dolphins on this kind of study that they were looking at with compression and putting on barometric pressure. But just kind of neat stuff. So I'm trying to keep you involved in Science Daily. Yes? Okay. Questions? Let's go for it.
Questions. It's your time for asking questions.
And we can draw things on the board. We can do whatever you like. The test, yeah, everybody wants to know about the test, right?
Yeah.
It's so hard. No, just joking. And when is it?
Tuesday. 8 a.m.,
right. Oh, I have to send this quiz to somebody here in a minute. Did I log out? No. Okay. We got a quiz coming up, too. So, Tuesday, 8 a.m., multiple choice. Is it easy? I've said that before, but this time it's really easy. I even took questions from 152, okay? Bio 152. And so I think some of you are going to finish in like 35 minutes because you're going to go down and say, oh, that was too easy, right? And then you're going to question yourselves, and what are you going to do? Probably change your answer to the wrong answer. And so you don't do that. All right. So you go with the answer that you first have, and as you're changing your answer, be really careful about why you're changing your answer. But do read all the answers in the question first, right? And then go through the process of elimination. All right.
Is it 50% old stuff and new stuff?
Oh, so the question was about 50% old stuff, new stuff. The majority of it, it's 150 points, right? So around, I think it's about 95 points or so, 96, you know, is from the last test. All right, so you focus on the material that we covered since the last test. And then about 52 or 4 points or so is material from the test 1 and test 2. Now, if you divide that up, it's like 24 points, right, or something like that, 24 and 20. So then you have, if you have multiple choice questions, 2 points each, that's only like 12 questions from the first exam, and only like 12 questions from the second exam, right? So it's really not that much, but you don't want to miss those 12 points because that brings you from there to there, right? And it's not just the point because it's 150 points, right? So you got to add that up. Some people had questions about bloody average on the second exam. You look down on, what's that thing called? Canvas. But it doesn't give you the right information because you don't realize that some people that missed the exams, I just put in a 0 for those people. Or some people that, you know, were sick or they were gone, I put 0s in there and it averages that whole column and gives you a lower percentage when you see that column. So it's a misconception on your part to look at those columns and think about the average on there because some people might have 0s in there, which really brings the class average down, right? Until I put the grades and missing grades. So some people are sick, some people have car accidents, some people have other things that have to deal with. Like, you know, you think about it, there's some people that are really having some issues that have to deal with life crises in here too. Right? So it's you know, be happy with where you are. Okay, so other questions specifically? I wouldn't get that detailed in here for this. Think about both of them entering into the small intestine and releasing
contents. In the pancreas, there's a lot of pancreatic enzymes. The gallbladder, bile salts. That's the main thing.
Is the pancreatic kind of alkalized?
Yes. Yes. Bicarb. Heavy on bicarb.
So they came in the same time?
But it depends on the diet somewhat, too, right? They're not the same track, right? Because the liver goes down the common bile to the gallbladder, and then that exits out into the small intestine. The pancreas has its own pancreatic duct to the small intestine. And that can cause problems for people. Sometimes you get it's called sphincter of Oude, and actually people have problems with that, and they can actually have serious problems and have pancreatitis, for example, and die.
So when you're talking about like renal secretion, do you mean that like distal tubule is secreting something into the bloodstream, or does the bloodstream secrete something into the bloodstream?
So the question was about renal secretion. It's the blood secreting into the primary urine, right? And a lot of that happens in the distal tubule, like antibiotics, like creatinine, okay? Other severe questions. And some people send emails to ask certain questions, and what do I do with them? I give them a Google link. Usually. So you can actually sometimes, some of these things hit Google. So a lot of this is from the last exam. So what did we cover since the last exam? Anybody remember? Respiratory.
Urinary.
Renal. Osmoregulation. Regulation. And GI, right? And then a little bit of the last stuff we just covered here with temperature, which I hope you can retain for a few minutes more, right? Okay. All right. So, yes?
Were you explaining the balloon and Clausius-Fox analogy against the
The what?
The balloon and Clausius-Fox.
Oh, so the balloon and the box is basically about how your lungs inflate, right? So if you had a box, closed box with a rubber on the bottom, and you had a balloon that's in this box, and you sealed it around, but you had the balloon opening. If you pulled the bottom of that box down, right, what's going to happen? You get a negative pressure inside the box, the balloon will inflate. If you push up on it, you push the positive pressure in there, and it's going to collapse that balloon, right, and push the air out. That's how your lungs are like that balloon, and the rubber on the bottom of that box is like the diaphragm. Now, you have other muscles for, like, really breathing in, right? Which ones are those? Your intercostal and external, because you're going to bring in external air, right? And that's when you want to take a deep breath, you raise your ribs, but if you're going to forcefully breathe out, you use your getting internal air out, so you use your internal intercostals to contract down, force air out. Does that help? All right, you had a question?
I was going to ask, are we going to have, like, multiple choice that's, like, extra multiple choice for bonus points or anything? Like
there's
some,
I think I made some bonus questions in there. So you could make a greater than 100%. I have a feeling the average will be high. And I made it a little bit easier because I think our lab, maybe I should cut this thing off, the lab grades might be a little bit low. So the final exam is a little bit easier to try to bring people back up. Okay, does that help a little bit?
Yes,
I know that
very much so. Okay.
So that will help, I think, with a lot. And the last quiz was supposed to be easy. We did have people leave things blank for some reason. I don't know why.
The stuff with like all the equations with the different respiratory pressures and like, or the, it was the gas, like the CO2, pH.
Oh, yeah.
Can you put those, like, links to those quizzes up?
What you got?
What?
Don't you have the quiz? Did you throw
one? No. The one that was, like, I mean, it was one of those questions was the ones that were online.
Yeah. Those quizzes, what were online, that's on your lab page, your course page.
Okay.
There's links for the respiratory gases that's on your web page, you know, like the ones we had on the quiz before. So you go to those and you can look through those and give. And there's tons of websites for those. But some of them are much more detailed than what we've covered. They're talking about, you know, really some little subtleties that I don't want to get into in here. But then those are good study guides. You can look up, you know, ANP, Anatomy and Physiology Question Test Bank. And you can pull, you know, look at those and give it as a study guide for you. So those are really helpful. All right. Other burning questions. If you have questions on old exams, don't just say, is A right or B right? Kind of like maybe justify it and then ask, hey, is that right? I'm a little confused with this. And then
you know, help you out as best I can. Might give you a Google site, who knows. but, you know, it's to try to help you get the ideas if you're confused on something. Good. Are we all ready for Tuesday? We're going to do really well? Yes? Okay. I think it's going to be quite straightforward and easy. It's not meant to be hard. And you think that questions are tricky. They're not meant to be tricky. You might be reading into it too much. Straight answers, straightforward questions. I got to give this quiz to somebody.
Wait, is there short answer? There's short answer, right?
I don't think I have any short answers.
Not on the final class?
No.
Oh.
Maybe one or two. No, I don't think I have any, actually. But there might be something. Multiple choices.